Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. In today's weather, we'll have mostly sunny skies in the Cedar Rapids area with a high of 81. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low of 59. We have a waxing crescent moon, and today we'll enjoy 14 hours and 44 minutes of daylight, with sunset tonight at 8:35 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 5:51 a.m. And the big headline on the front page of today's Gazette, Iowa City Mayor issues mandatory mask order. This is a story by Michaela Ram of the Gazette. Mayor Bruce Teague has issued a proclamation requiring Iowa City residents to wear face masks as a preventive measure to the novel coronavirus pandemic, making Iowa City the second municipality to push back on state officials' stance that local governments have no legal authority to issue such orders. Effective immediately, individuals must wear a mask, face shield, or other facial covering across their nose and mouth while in public settings across Iowa City, with some exceptions. The announcement comes as the rate of new positive COVID-19 tests continues to rise across the state, totaling to more than 39,000 cases in Iowa and reaching one-day totals not seen since May. With thousands of students expected to return to the University of Iowa campus starting next month and K-12 school districts resuming in the fall, Teague stated in his announcement Tuesday, quote, "The time for action is now," end quote. Quote, "Simply put, by wearing a face mask, you are showing your fellow residents that you care about them," Teague said in a Facebook Live video. Quote, "If we comply with this order, Iowa City will see the difference. We're all in this together, and that means we can all play our part," end quote. Earlier this month, Governor Kim Reynolds said local governments have no legal authority to implement mask requirements because they are not consistent with her emergency orders in response to COVID-19, which don't require Iowans to wear face coverings. Quote, "Governor Reynolds encourages Iowans who are interacting with others where social distancing is impossible to wear masks, but she does not believe a governmental mask mandate is appropriate," Pat Garrett, spokesman for the governor's office, said in an email Tuesday. Garrett also cited previous statements made by Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller. In a memo on the Attorney General's website, Miller states local officials, quote, "must act in a manner which is consistent with the orders and directions," end quote, from the governor and the Iowa Department of Public Health. The Iowa City Proclamation, which expires September 15th, states residents and visitors are required to wear face coverings in public places, including public transportation, outdoor spaces, quote, "if keeping 6 feet away from others is not possible," end quote, indoor public settings such as grocery stores, retail stores, and other public settings, quote, "that are not one's place of residence," end quote. Individuals do not have to wear masks when they are alone or with members of their household. They also aren't required to wear masks during exercise, while eating and drinking at a food establishment, or when they're obtaining a service that would require temporary removal of a face covering. However, individuals who are exempt from the rules include those aged younger than 2 years, those who have trouble breathing, those who have been told by medical, behavioral, and legal professionals not to wear face coverings, and those actively engaged in a public safety role, such as law enforcement and emergency medical personnel. Those not adhering to the new mandate could be charged with a simple misdemeanor, according to the three-page proclamation, but Teague told the Gazette the city isn't eager to issue citations. Instead, if the police are called, they would educate on the importance of wearing a mask. Quote, "It's our full hope and intent we won't have to issue any infractions because of this," Teague said. Quote, "We want to educate and ensure that if there are any barriers to having face masks, we make it so the barrier is no longer there," end quote. Other nearby cities are considering issuing similar proclamations mandating face masks across Johnson County in the hopes it would create a stronger, unified response to COVID-19, according to discussions during the Johnson County Joint Entities meeting held via Zoom on Monday. Johnson County Public Health Director Dave Koch asked local municipalities to take on resolutions requiring masks while in public, saying it was important officials be firm on the importance of this public health measure. The draft language presented to local officials by the County Public Health Department, quote, "can address pockets where public health measures are not being implemented," said Sam Jarvis, community health manager at Johnson County Public Health. Coralville Mayor John Lundell already issued a proclamation this past Tuesday asking individuals and businesses to, quote, comply with recommended practices to reduce the virus spread, end quote, which include use of face masks and face shields, as well as social distancing. However, instead of issuing a mandate, the Coralville City Council decided earlier this month that it should simply be a strong encouragement to residents. The mayor of Muscatine issued the first face mask mandate in the state on July 5th, setting a major pushback to Reynolds and Miller's stance that local control does not supersede the governor's emergency proclamation. But it soon lost its effectiveness after the Muscatine City Council prohibited any funds or city staff's time to be used in regards to enforcing the proclamation. Quote, however, questions remain on the scope of local control during the pandemic, as Iowa Code still grants cities and counties power to preserve and improve the peace, safety, welfare, comfort, and convenience of their residents, end quote, according to a memo from the Attorney General's office. Teague cited sections within the Iowa Code and state constitution that reaffirm a municipality's power to determine local affairs, as well as two Iowa Supreme Court rulings from 1990 and 1978 that allow a city to set standards, quote, more stringent than those imposed by state law, unless a state law provides otherwise, end quote. In other front page news, Brooklyn Drazy of the Gazette reports it's now or never for spotting Comet Neowise. Iowans have the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity this week to see Comet Neowise over the horizon before it disappears to the outer edge of the solar system. And that's not the only thing expected to light up the night sky this summer, offering a diversion, if only fleeting from the pandemic that has kept so many cooped up. The Perseids meteor shower will streak across the sky around August 11th through 12th, and satellites can be seen passing overhead if one knows where to look. Comet Neowise, discovered only this spring, won't pass by the Earth for another 7,000 years or so. The comet is named after NASA's Near-Earth Object Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. Neowise will be at its brightest Wednesday, said University of Iowa Van Allen Observatory's manager, Caroline Roberts. Then the comet's light will dim as it moves away from the sun until it is no longer visible. She pointed out that comets of this brightness pass the Earth only every 5 years or so, and brighter comets appear only every 15 to 20 years. Quote, this is the brightest one we've certainly had in a while, Roberts said. The comet sits about 20 degrees away from the horizon, Roberts said, and looks stationary from the ground. The best time to look for it is around 10 p.m. People should let their eyes adjust to the darkness for a bit before trying to find the comet, which is visible to the naked eye. People can measure 20 degrees with two fist lengths above the horizon. She recommended getting away from the city lights and having a good view of the northwest horizon, perhaps by going to Lake McBride's boat pavilion to see. Spectators can use binoculars to actually see water coming off the comet. The Perseids meteor shower next month also will be visible to the naked eye, and binoculars are not recommended since no one knows just where they will pop up. Meteor showers actually are very common, Roberts said, though only three or four a year are large enough for people to see. Small meteor showers are happening right now, but the Perseids will be visible because the Earth will be passing through a particularly dense area of particles left over from passing comets. Roberts recommends finding a place with little light pollution and without the sky being obstructed by trees or buildings. Look up at the sky and wait. The moon will be half full during the shower, which Roberts said isn't the most ideal situation because of its brightness. But meteors still should be visible as flashes across the sky. Satellites are constantly orbiting the Earth and being lighted up by the sun, so finding them is just a matter of knowing where to look. Websites and apps can help pinpoint space objects, and in the sky they slowly flash bright, then fade while moving across the sky. One source for information about spotting the International Space Station is NASA. Visit the website spotthestation.nasa.gov/sightings/index.cfm to find out how to spot it from your location. Wedding photographer Michael Huang challenged himself to take a photograph of Comet Neowise in downtown Cedar Rapids after having an easier time getting a good picture at his friend's farm north of Alburnett. He couldn't see the comet while downtown, but he knew where it was supposed to be, so it took a bit of guessing. Quote, I set the camera up, pointing in the general direction, then looked on the camera to see if I captured it after a long exposure, Huang said. Huang said that he'll try and get out to take photos of the Perseids meteor shower if the weather cooperates, but no one can say yet if the sky will be clear. Quote, it all depends on the weather, Huang said. In other front-page news, Grace King of the Gazette reports, Iowa City School District still committed to virtual learning, awaiting waiver approval from state. The Iowa City Community School District, which announced only a week ago students wouldn't return to face-to-face learning until October 6th at the earliest, now is reworking its plan after Governor Kim Reynolds ordered Friday that districts offer some in-person classes unless they get permission. Although the district has submitted a waiver request to the state asking to provide only online instruction at the beginning of the academic year, the school board also presented six continuum of learning models Tuesday evening during a special session. Quote, we affirm our plans for online learning and commitment to them and feel this is our best approach, said Interim Superintendent Matt Degner. But, quote, to be in compliance with the governor's proclamation, we have some additional work to do, end quote. The learning models range from 100% off-site learning for pre-kindergarten to 12th graders to daily on-site learning with health and safety measures enacted to the extent possible. A majority of off-site learning model offers continuous online learning with only up to 25% of students returning to classrooms on any given day. A hybrid learning model proposes students learn on-site for 2 days a week. Half of students would attend class in person on so-called A days, and the other half would attend on so-called B days. Remote learning would take place when students are not on campus. A second hybrid learning model proposes pre-kindergarten through fourth graders attend in-person classes daily except Wednesdays. Fifth through 12th graders attend in-person classes 2 days a week, with 50% of students on so-called A days and 50% of students on so-called B days. Remote learning takes place when students are not on campus. The last model suggests half of students pre-kindergarten through 12th grade on so-called A days and half on so-called B days with a rotating schedule of AAA, BB, and AABBB every other week. For all learning models, parents would have the choice of enrolling students in a virtual learning program. Sean Eystone, the board president, school board president, said nothing about the coronavirus pandemic has improved in a way that makes the district feel more comfortable reopening schools. School board member Janet Godwin said Iowa City is in a, quote, unique position, end quote, as thousands of University of Iowa students return to campus. Quote, they've been all over the world. I think this makes the community stand out differently from the rest of the state. We are unique given this large influx of people coming back to our community, Godwin said. School board member Lisa Williams said if a family needs predictability and consistency, the most predictable model of learning the district can offer is virtual. Quote, the more families that opt into the online system, the more resources we will be able to devote to that program. If we get 20% of parents opting in, we're looking at putting 20% of our teaching staff online. If we get 80%, we're going to put 80% of our teaching staff online, Williams said. Parents and students can begin registering for the 2020-2021 school year beginning Monday on the PowerSchool online portal. Families will be asked if they intend to have students attend class in person or virtually, or select an alternative plan as a preference. No decisions about how athletics or extracurricular activities have been made yet. The Gazette reports an Operation Quick Find issued for a Cedar Rapids 12-year-old boy. The Cedar Rapids police have issued an Operation Quick Find for a 12-year-old boy missing since Wednesday. Makai Amir Boyce was last seen in the 300 block of 16th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids at 11:16 a.m. July 15th. Makai is a black male, 5 feet 11 inches tall and 120 pounds. He has a scar on his right forearm. Please contact the Cedar Rapids Police Department if you have any information about where Makai might be found. Also in the Iowa Today section, Gage Miskimen reports, Marion landfill capacity could be extended through 2074, says Solid Waste Agency. The Solid Waste Agency presented its proposal to the Marion City Council to extend the capacity of the Marion landfill through 2074. During Tuesday's work session, Agency Board Chairman Scott Olson and Communications Director Joe Horaney gave a video presentation to council members for the agency, proposing a cell modification at the landfill located at 1954 County Home Road. Quote, "There are not many other options if the landfill closes for our county," said Olson, who is also a Cedar Rapids City Council member. Quote, "We wanted to start a dialogue for what happens in 25 years," end quote. Horaney said that cell modification would serve local industry and economic development while supporting local programs and projects. Expansion would extend its current capacity, which is through 2044, by 30 years. An agreement from 2006 requires Marion City Council to approve any amendment to the current plan. Excavation would then begin this year, and construction of the additional cell would occur in 2021, Horaney said. The agreement between Marion and the agency reopened the Marion landfill after Mount Trashmore in Cedar Rapids was closed in 2006. The final elevation of the landfill was not to exceed 914 feet above sea level, and the setback of the footprint of the landfill from Artesian Road would be 1,800 feet. Residents and city council members have voiced their concerns in the past on potential negative effects a potential expansion could have on the city, which is growing in the direction of the landfill. During the presentation, Horaney said, if approved, the cell modification would not change the current boundaries of the landfill, as the overall property boundary would remain the same. Quote, "I understand Marion feels like the dumping ground for the entire county," Horaney said in the video. The agency handles around 200,000 tons of garbage each year, with the city of Marion accounting for 3.28% of the landfill's customers by tonnage. But Horaney pointed out that many Marion residents work for companies in Cedar Rapids that contribute a lot of that percentage. Horaney listed benefits of keeping the landfill where it is, including holding market rates steady, continuing subsidized diversion programs and education programs at Linmar and Marion Independent, as well as a host fee paid to Marion that would be determined after discussions between Marion and the agency. Horaney said a host fee would provide the city with 50 years of revenue and 25 additional years of solid waste service for residences and businesses. Quote, "Could a viable alternative for waste removal emerge in 20 years, 10 years, or 1 year? Absolutely," Horaney said. Quote, "Having extra capacity is like insurance in case a viable alternative does not emerge," end quote. The city of Marion would have to consider allowing the setback to be changed by amending the current agreement and the 28E agreement and enter into discussion with the Cedar Rapids Linn County Solid Waste Agency for the host fee rate. Or the city could choose to leave the settlement agreement as is. If terms are reached, the agency's founding members, the City of Cedar Rapids and Linn County, would have to approve changing the 28E agreement as well, and Marion's Planning and Zoning Commission would have to approve any landfill design plans. If Marion decides to leave the settlement agreement as is, the agency's board of directors would have to seek alternatives, such as finding a new landfill to accept garbage after 2044. Aaron Murphy of the Gazette, Des Moines Bureau, reports, Eric Brandstatt says Trump's Iowa operation, quote, triple, end quote, that of 2016. Every U.S. president in his lifetime, Republican or Democrat, has had an it factor, according to Eric Brandstatt, son of the former Iowa governor and an Iowa operative for the Trump campaign. While Brandstatt said he can't describe it, he says Republican President Donald Trump has it, and Democratic challenger Joe Biden does not. That, in part, is why Brandstatt said he is confident Trump will once again win Iowa on his way to another four-year term in the White House. Quote, "To be honest, I've never been more confident," Brandstatt, a senior advisor to the Trump campaign in Iowa, said Wednesday during an interview in Des Moines, quote, "but not cocky," end quote. The most recent public polling on the presidential race in Iowa shows a close race in a state that Trump won in 2016 by nearly 10 points. Pollster Seltzer & Company with the Des Moines Register and public policy polling in early June showed Trump leading Biden in the state by less than 2 points within the poll's margin of error. Quote, "I'm not at all concerned. The polls are what they are," said Brandstatt, son of former Iowa Governor Terry Brandstatt. Quote, "But I think at the end of the day, what we saw was Trump changed the electoral map," end quote. To that end, Brandstatt said he does not subscribe to the theory that if Trump faces a competitive race in a state he won so handily 4 years ago, he will lose the national election because he is in trouble in other states he won by slimmer margins. Quote, I think that's laughable, Branstad said, noting Trump in 2016 became just the second Republican presidential candidate to win Iowa in the past 8 general elections. Quote, we've always been a purple state. It always takes working hard and having the right candidate, having the right message, and putting those things together, end quote. Branstad extolled the expansion of the Trump campaigns and Republican party's operations in Iowa. While a party spokeswoman said the party did not make staffing numbers public, Branstad described the operation as, quote, triple, end quote, what it was in 2016. The Republican Party said it had made more than 1 million voter contacts this year, as it had built on a campaign organization that essentially never left after the 2016 elections. Quote, I'm really impressed with the team we've put together, Branstad said. Quote, we have built the best team with the best technology. We are ready to win big league, and we're looking to November for more unified as Republicans than ever before, and we are really excited to get the message out to voters, end quote. The Biden campaign's Iowa State Director, Lauren Dillon, suggested in a statement that Iowa will flip back to the Democratic candidate in the November election. Quote, after inheriting and then decimating a robust farm economy and botching our national pandemic response, Donald Trump's support is quickly unraveling in Iowa, Dillon said in a statement provided by the Biden campaign. Quote, voters of all political stripes are hungry for leadership that can unite instead of divide us and help build back our economy better than it was before. That's Joe Biden, end quote. Let's turn now to the Insight page in today's Gazette. It includes a guest column written by Iowa City resident Jane Peck Belfance, titled, Opening Schools at What Cost, Governor Reynolds? As a retired elementary school counselor, I strongly disagree with Governor Kim Reynolds' mandate of on-campus education with coronavirus numbers rising in our state. Let me give you a view of what this will look like in schools. 1. The number one mental health issue with children today is anxiety. Kids know what's going on with COVID-19, thus increasing their anxieties. School refusal will become more of a problem than it already is within the population of anxious students. 2. Already overburdened staff pre-COVID will have more preventive steps to take in addition to getting in the required minutes of academic time. Think, putting boots on young students in winter is a seasonal problem. It takes so much time. With COVID-19, making sure students keep their hands washed, noses wiped, and masks on all the time, that, along with constantly keeping surfaces clean, will exponentially consume much more teachers' time, and still more academic minutes will be subtracted from school until the virus is over. 3. The already paltry school funding will be further diminished by spending money for COVID-19 protection, i.e. shields for the secretary's desks, hand sanitizer, PPEs, air purifiers, and much more. Yes, I know there has been some funding, but I doubt it's enough. We still don't know what we don't know about COVID-19. 4. Students and staff will die or become sick or disabled for a long time or permanently. Do you realize what this does to a school? Whenever a student or staff member dies, the whole school is affected. Grief counseling is necessary for the time it takes to become learning ready again. There simply won't be enough personnel available from the AEA crisis teams to take this on. 5. Substitute teachers will be in very short supply. Lowering the qualifications for substitutes is not what's in students' best interests. In fact, it's academically unsound and potentially dangerous. 6. There will be teacher burnout. Each year, more teachers drop out from the jobs they love because of unsupported mandates, lack of supplies and money, and unachievable expectations that make joy in this career untenable. There will be yet more teacher dropouts this year. The governor says that educators are essential workers. Indeed, they are, but they are not babysitters to ensure mom and dad get to work. That's not their function. They are to teach. There is no more blood in the turnip, Governor. 7. Experienced teachers will opt out, especially those who are 60 and beyond. An unmentored teaching force is not the best Iowa can offer students. Part of new teacher growth comes from having an experienced mentor. We haven't been number one for a long time now, Governor, have we? We will further descend the ladder. Your mandate is unreasonable and perplexing, especially since it's incongruent with the medical profession's recommendations. In fact, it seems to be a political action instead of interest in students' education. You want students in school. At what cost, Governor? At what cost? You will be forever in debt for the death and disabilities arising from your mandate. Again, this guest column was written by Jane Peck Belvance, who lives in Iowa City. Today's Gazette also includes a column by staff member Liz Lentz. Her column today is titled, Iowa is getting worse at testing, not better. We are 5 months into a pandemic, and we should be getting better at testing for the virus, not worse. But in Iowa, Governor Kim Reynolds is leaning heavily on Test Iowa, a public-private partnership to expand testing. But Test Iowa is holding up just as well as a drunk man's ability to social distance. For weeks, Iowans have been reporting frustration with finding testing times. In response to those questions, Amy McCoy, a spokeswoman for the Iowa Department of Public Health, told me that testing sites have been overwhelmed and that the governor was looking into expanding testing sites. But she provided no further details on where or when the expansion would occur. Instead, on Monday, the Test Iowa site in Dubuque County announced it was limiting testing to 100 tests per day. Pat Garrett, the governor's spokesman, who has bragged on Twitter about the governor's transparency, didn't respond to my questions about the cutback, but he did respond to Iowa News Now, stating, quote, "We requested this temporary change to ensure that their process is in line with others across the state of Iowa. We want to maintain consistency and high-quality performance across all Test Iowa sites," end quote. That sounds like an answer, but isn't. Instead, it raises more questions, such as, was it not high quality before? And if so, how and why? I contacted both Dubuque County and Epic Wellness, the site contracted out through Test Iowa, to conduct testing, but received no further clarity. This comes after a weekend where a testing backlog delayed reporting of COVID-19 cases in the state. The backlog was, according to McCoy, because of a data reporting error, but she again offered no further clarity on what that error was or how it's being resolved. Despite the lack of testing, it's still easier to get a COVID-19 test than an answer about Iowa's pandemic response from the governor's office. Last week, an audit of Test Iowa's reporting process deemed it illegal because it violated the state guidelines for immediate reporting of test results. In the audit, Iowa State's auditor reported that Test Iowa reports test results to data companies in Utah before reporting them to the state. The audit found, quote, "The reporting chain for Test Iowa results is contrary to law, takes apparently pointless risks, and exposes taxpayers to potential legal liabilities," end quote. The audit also found that there have been widespread issues with equipment problems, reporting delays, and of course, don't forget the problem with unusable tests. All while cases are surging, spiking, rolling, boiling, overwhelming our state and our nation. Reynolds repeatedly has said that she's been opening testing sites based on so-called data, but Dubuque County is a hotspot for COVID-19 cases in the nation, which would mean we need more testing, not less. But hey, bars and theme parks are open. And Reynolds is trusting Iowans to, quote, do the right thing, end quote. The whole experience of living in Iowa and America in this moment feels like being on the Hindenburg and being blamed it's sinking because you aren't flapping your arms hard enough to fly. Again, this was an editorial column written by Liz Lentz of the Gazette. In today's letters to the editor in the Gazette, Stephanie Manning of Iowa City writes, "It's time for educational innovation. As a former elementary principal in both rural and urban districts in Iowa, I wonder why schools are not utilizing this gift of time to innovate and recreate schools as we know them. We know that many children do not thrive in our current educational system, and yet we continue to do the same thing year after year. Why not gather the best teachers together and have them create the ideal school? We may not be able to actually bring that ideal into reality, but if we had a new prototype to aim toward, we might find we could intervene on the cycles we see that aren't working. Is it possible that students from different economic and cultural backgrounds would thrive in differently structured classrooms? Would it make more sense to offer different experiences to children who are opportunity challenged due to their loving family's economic situation? Does every elementary teacher need to create the same online learning lessons, or should we assign our most gifted teachers to do that and use this time to grow the skills, talents, and abilities of our other teachers? Should some teachers be staffing phones to assist students who struggle with at-home learning or assist parents and grandparents who are stressed, teaching their children at home? So many questions that we could use this time to answer. This pandemic could be a catalyst for change if educational leaders, both in administration and in the classroom, took actions to make it so." Signed, Stephanie Manning of Iowa City. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Anamosa, Alva F. Melchers, aged 76, died Wednesday, March 18th. Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello is handling arrangements. Center Point, Joyce Schultz, aged 77, died Tuesday, July 11th. Arrangements by Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. Elgin, Earl Jean West, aged 74, died Tuesday, July 21st. Arrangements by Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Elgin. Fayette, Burton L. Odekirk, aged 94, died Saturday, July 18th. Arrangements by Becker Milne's Funeral Home in Fayette. Manchester, Robert L. Weber, aged 80, died Monday, July 20th. Arrangements by Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester. Olwine, Ace A. Reeves, aged 9, died Sunday, July 19th. Arrangements by Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home in Olwine. Patrick Alberts, aged 66, of Cedar Rapids, passed away surrounded by his loving family on Sunday, July 19th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldhorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha after a long illness. Private family services will take place at a later date. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services of Cedar Rapids is caring for Pat and his family. Patrick Lee Alberts was born May 22, 1954, in Cedar Rapids, to Leo and Carol Milner Alberts. He graduated from Kennedy High School, then joined the Air Force in 1972, serving as a weapons mechanic. Pat was proud of his service in the military. Upon return home, he attended Kirkwood to begin a career in welding and fabricating. He worked mostly on small engines and was great with his hands. He even dabbled in carpentry. He loved fishing, going to the casino, and was an avid Green Bay Packers fan. Go Pack, go! Donald Ralph Carr, aged 79, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, July 18th, at his home. A visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, July 26th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Burial services will be Monday, July 27th, at Mount Calvary Cemetery, at a time to be determined. Ron was born September 12, 1940, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Ralph Edgar Carr and Rayona May Caraway. He married Barbara Varner on March 15, 1991, in Hiawatha. Ron worked for Rockwell Collins for 42 years. Ron was a simple man who enjoyed the little things in life. You could either find him in the garage tinkering, in the backyard splitting wood, or by the fire enjoying a cold one. He wasn't much of a social butterfly, but he enjoyed the company of family without being the center of attention. Big-hearted is an understatement. He was generous and supportive to all those around him, whether you needed a good laugh, with his quick-witted humor, or advice from a wise man. To have him in your life was truly a blessing. Joyce Eileen Gerhardt, age 92, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, July 18th, at West Ridge Care Center of Natural Causes. Services will be 11 a.m. Friday, July 24th, at Tehan Funeral Home. Burial will be at Cedar Memorial Cemetery. Friends may visit the family after 10 a.m. Friday. Joyce was born October 21st, 1927, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Curtis and Louise McGregor Gerhardt. She graduated from McKinley High School in 1946. She worked at Claxton Pharmacy, Chandler's, Lape's Florist, and Dr. Seerlich's office. Joyce enjoyed baseball, the Yankees, arranging flowers and stock car races, 4th of July picnics, but most importantly, spending time with her nieces and nephews, whom she loved more than anything. Memorials may be directed to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Dolores Kathleen Meyer, aged 98, loving wife, adoring mother and grandmother, and cherished friend to all who knew her, passed peacefully to her eternal life on Sunday, July 19th, at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Friends and family may visit from 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday, July 25th, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Private family services will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, and burial will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. The funeral service will be live-streamed at 2:30 p.m. Saturday and may be viewed at client.tribucast.com/TCID/519170004. Dolores was born March 2, 1927, and raised on a farm in Cahokia, Missouri. Her amazing work ethic traced back to her childhood days. As the oldest of three children, she was tasked with more than her share of responsibilities, including helping her siblings, Carolyn and Chuck. She attended a one-room schoolhouse with less than 10 children, and as one of the oldest students, would often help teach the younger children as well. Upon graduation from Clark County High School in 1943, she moved to Burlington, Iowa, where she sorted cookies on the Iowa Biscuit Company. After handling burning hot cookies for a short time, she decided it was time to find a new job and moved into a typing position. Dolores is survived by her husband of 75 years, Donald Henry Meyer, her three children, Tom of Orland, Indiana, Deborah of Cedar Rapids, and Karen of Iowa City. Memorial donations may be directed to the family, and online condolences may be directed to the family at www.cedarmemorial.com. John James Gunn Sr., known as Jim, age 91, died peacefully at St. Luke's Hospital on Monday, May 4th. Celebration of life will be 11 o'clock on Monday, July 27th at Lisbon United Methodist Church, with a time for fellowship following. Private graveside services at Campbell Cemetery following the fellowship. Arrangements by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. June Violet Grigsby McCoy, aged 84, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully at home on July 16th, surrounded by her loving family after a brief battle with cancer. She was born to Charles Albert Grigsby and Violet Louise Wolfe Grigsby on April 6, 1936, in Columbus, Ohio. They moved to Cedar Rapids in 1965, where they settled to raise their family and pastor the First Pentecostal Church. She is survived by her husband, the Reverend James Oy O. McCoy, one brother, Harold Mary Grigsby of Kokomo, Indiana, and four children. June's memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, July 23rd, at River of Life, 3801 Blair's Ferry Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids. In honor of her life and love for color, she would appreciate everyone wearing colors to celebrate her life. June hated the color black. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the Churches of Marion Food Pantry. Robert E. Patrick of Cedar Rapids passed away July 15th, peacefully after a very long illness with cancer and AL amyloidosis, a rare protein disorder, which also affected his lungs and heart. He was 67 years old. Susan and Bob can't thank his numerous doctors and staff of Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago enough that helped make Bob make it as far as he did. He was under constant treatment from March 2010 until his passing. Most of all, Bob would like to thank his wife, Susan, for never leaving his side when he was hospitalized numerous times. Her prayers and dedication made life all the more precious and worthwhile. They were married October 15, 1983, in Peoria, Illinois. Bob graduated from Washington High School in Cedar Rapids in 1971. He attended Iowa State University for his Bachelor of Science and Nova Southeastern University for his MBA. He will be cremated and his ashes spread at a later date, with a private celebration of life to follow. James A. Falk, aged 74, of rural Decorah, died peacefully Sunday, July 19th. James was born October 4, 1945, in La Crosse, Wisconsin, to Alvin and Olive Sersland Falk. He grew up on the family farm in Hesper Township, graduated from Decorah High School in 1963, and in 1969 obtained his Bachelor of Arts degree in economics from Mankato State University. On March 10, 1979, he married Katie Anderson. He had been an examiner for the Iowa Department of Banking from 1971 to 1978. Since 1978, James operated the family farm in Winnesheik County, producing cash, grain, and beef. From 1986 to 1987, he was the senior special credit officer at Farm Credit Services of Southeast Minnesota in Preston, and from 1987 to 1988 was the senior vice president of the 9th District Farm Credit Bank. Since 1989, he was involved with Falk & Associates. He is survived by his wife, Katie, a son, Patrick, and his dog, Helpful. Gravesite services will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, July 23rd, at Phelps Cemetery in Decorah, with the Reverend Richard Simon Hansen officiating. Mangus Funeral Home in Mabel, Minnesota, is assisting with arrangements. Larry Thomas Funk, aged 59, of Chicago and formerly of Edgewood, Iowa, passed away Sunday, July 19th, at Amita Health Resurrection Medical Center in Chicago. Larry was born December 12, 1960, in Manchester, to James and Kathleen McMullen Funk, and was raised and educated in the Edgewood area. He was an EDCO graduate and received his BA from the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Larry worked as a computer analyst with the Chicago Transit Authority. He enjoyed spending time in Backbone State Park, loved music, spending time with family and friends, and especially enjoyed family vacations at Lake Okoboji. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonardmullerfh.com. Private family mass of Christian burial will be at St. Mark Catholic Church, with interment at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Greeley, Iowa. A public celebration of life will be held at a later date. Dave Studd of Mount Vernon, aged 77, died Sunday, July 19, at Hallmark Care Center in Mount Vernon. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 23rd, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Graveside service with military honors will be at 10 a.m. Friday, July 24th, at Mount Vernon Memorial Cemetery. David Arthur Studd was born November 4, 1942, in Marion, to Jacob and Mary Haynes Studd. He graduated from Mount Vernon High School in 1962, then joined the U.S. Air Force, serving in the Philippines, Vietnam conflict, and Korea until 1966. He worked three jobs for as long as anyone can remember for the city of Mount Vernon, as a Mount Vernon firefighter and at Lang's Texaco and later Sinclair. He enjoyed spending time in the bowling league with his brothers, who made up the Stormwatch team. Dave met Donna Edmonds while bowling, and they were married January 12, 1977. Dave was always busy and was an incredible worker. He got things done his way or the highway, but everyone knew he was a guy who could always be relied on. He was preceded in death by his parents, brothers Lawrence, Jake, and Harold, Vernon and Tom, and infant brother Myron, and sisters Mary Ann and Lorraine. Please share your support and memories with Dave's family on his tribute wall at www.stuartbaxter.com. Kathleen Ann Stallman Bossler of Van Horn, aged 77, passed away peacefully on Sunday, July 19th at Garden View Care Center in O'Fallon, Missouri. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6:45 p.m. Friday, July 24th, with a memorial service beginning at 7 p.m. at Phillips Funeral Home in Keystone. Interment will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday at St. Patrick Catholic Cemetery in Fairfax. Kathleen was born March 4, 1943, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Francis and Evelyn Boddicker Stallman. She graduated from Van Horn High School. On July 1, 1965, she was united in marriage to Gary Bossler in Van Horn. The couple farmed near Van Horn, and Kathleen worked as a secretary and bookkeeper at Farm Service in Van Horn for many years. She also worked as an assistant to Joe Conlon with Iowa Realty before moving to Missouri to be near her son Troy and his family. Online condolences may be left at www.phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Gerald L. Daines, known as Jerry, aged 56, of Iowa City, died Sunday, July 19th, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Private family services are being planned. For a complete obituary and to share a thought, memory, or condolence with Jerry's family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandchia.com. Joyce K. Durham, aged 67, died Sunday, July 19th, at her home in Lone Tree. Her family will greet friends from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, July 25th, at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. A celebration of Joyce's life will begin at 1 p.m. Instead of flowers and plants, memorials can be directed to the Joyce Durham Memorial Fund. A complete obituary can be found at www.lensingfuneral.com. And Gertrude E. Mayer of Mesa, Arizona, passed away on July 18th at the Mike Mikasa Nursing Center in Mesa, Arizona. She was the beloved daughter of the late Edward B. Mayer Sr. and Marquetta J. Mayer of Cedar Rapids. She was born November 25th, 1949, in Camp Stoneman, California. Gertie graduated from Cedar Falls High School and attended 2 years at UNI. She went on to barber school in Arizona and became a certified professional men's barber for over 30 years. She started her career at Mr. Perfect in Cedar Rapids and worked there for several years before opening her own barbershop in Elkader. Gertie retired back to Arizona in 2004. Cremation will take place at the Superstition Funeral Home in Apache Junction, Arizona. A private family burial will be held at Mount Calvary in Cedar Rapids. Donations in Gertie's memory may be made to the following: the American Stroke Association at stroke.org, American Cancer Society, and Mikasa Nursing Center Activities Office in Mesa, Arizona. And that concludes today's obituaries printed in the Gazette. On the front page of the Gazette's sports section, Jeff Linder reports, 11-inning marathon win sends Cedar Rapids Kennedy back to state softball. Unforgettable game, unfortunate ending, and for the Kennedy Cougars, a muted celebration. Maya Dodge's sky-high fly ball to left field was dropped with two outs in the 11th inning, and that enabled second-ranked Cedar Rapids Kennedy to escape Iowa City Liberty 1-0 in a Class 5A softball regional final Tuesday night at Kennedy High School. The Cougars, with a record of 23-1, won their 16th consecutive game, 8th straight via shutout, and advanced to the state tournament for the third time in 4 years. They will face number 9 Pleasant Valley with a record of 17-6 in a quarterfinal at 12:30 Monday afternoon at the Rogers Sports Complex in Fort Dodge. Many of the key players are frequent Fort Dodge visitors. Dodge will be making her first trip, but she was somewhat somber in the aftermath. Quote, "We had a lot of opportunities," she said. "I had a lot of at-bats, and I didn't adjust," end quote. As for the last play, quote, "I wasn't watching the ball," she said. "I was just running," end quote. Both pitchers were masterful. Kaylin Kinney, at 9-0, stretched her scoreless streak to 51 innings this season, scattering 5 hits, 3 to Briley Klosterman. Kinney struck out 8 and walked none. Quote, "Obviously, I'm a little fatigued," she said. "I knew I had to do this for the team. We came here and achieved our mission," end quote. Liberty's Kara Myers, 10-3, was just as effective, fanning 10 and walking 6. She allowed 7 hits. Quote, "She did everything we could ever ask her to do," Liberty coach Jeff Kelly said. Quote, "Maybe the 6th inning she lost touch on her rise ball, so it was just fastballs and changeups the rest of the way. It was just two outstanding pitchers going at it," end quote. Myers threw 180 pitches, Kinney 153. Alyssa Martin started Kennedy's winning rally with a one-out single. It was her 4th time on base. Addie Parker's groundout advanced Martin to second, and Kinney was intentionally walked. Up stepped Dodge, and the Cougars caught a break on the fly ball. Quote, "It wasn't pretty," Kennedy coach Madison LeClaire said, "but in all aspects of the game, I don't think we could have done any better tonight, and I don't think they could have either," end quote. Like Dodge said, the Cougars had prior opportunities, but stranded 13 runners in the first 10 innings before breaking through in the 11th. Liberty, with a record of 17-9, suffered a regional final heartbreak for the second straight year. In high school baseball news, K.J. Piltzer of the Gazette reports, Nathan Buddha McEnany pitches North Lynn back to state baseball tournament. North Lynn's Nathan McEnany received the lighthearted nickname Buddha. Family called him that for the way he would sit with each foot resting on the opposite when he was young. It stuck. Quote, "Ever since I was a little kid, everyone has been calling me that," McEnany said. "Now all my teammates have picked it up. Also, if they say if you run a Buddha's belly, if you rub a Buddha's belly, you have good luck. They do that, too," end quote. Aptly on Tuesday night, McEnany was zen-like on the mound for the second-ranked Lynx. The lefty starter pitched 6 2/3 innings of one-hit baseball with 9 strikeouts and helped North Lynn to a 6-3 victory over New Hampton in the Class 2A Substate 5 championship at Hertel Field. Quote, "Mac is always cool, calm, and collected," North Lynn coach Travis Griffith said. Quote, "You can't rattle him. It doesn't matter what happens. The demeanor doesn't change," end quote. He admitted to some early nerves as New Hampton parlayed a leadoff walk and an error in a 1-0 lead in the first. the Lynx, with a record of 18-2, answered with 3 in the bottom of the first. Consecutive singles for Austin Hilmer and Parker Becken sparked the offense. McEnany helped himself with an RBI single to plate Hilmer. Alex Sturbaum followed with a line drive single to left to make it 2-0. Lucas Voss scored on Corbin Wood's RBI groundout. Quote, "We came back and put up 3 right away, so that was some stress relief," McEnany said. "After the first inning, I felt wonderful. I kept shooting strikes," end quote. He stifled the Chickasaws with fastballs, a two-seamer that works in on right-handers and away on lefties, and a four-seamer with more velocity. Quote, "When the good Mac shows up, that's what you see," Griffith said. "He's got good stuff. He commands the strike zone." The velocity picked back up in the second. He started hitting his spots. When he's getting strikeouts looking, that means his two-seamer is diving, end quote. He held New Hampton hitless through 5 complete. Braden Anderson roped a double to lead off the 6th, ending the no-hit bid. Quote, "We were calling it in the dugout," McEnany said of the no-hit bid. "I was a little mad, but at least it was a good hard-hit double," end quote. The Lynx never trailed, padding their lead in the 4th, capitalizing on 2 errors for a 5-1 advantage. Ben Wheatley's RBI single scored Woods for an insurance run in the 6th. New Hampton tried to rally in the 7th, loading the bases on a hit batsman, error and walk. Ricky Babensee relieved McEnany and notched the final 2 outs. North Lynn was the 2A runner-up a year ago. The graduation of a successful senior class created some question marks, especially in a pandemic-shortened season with 4 freshmen and a couple sophomores in the lineup. The Lynx answered any doubts that remained from the start of the year. Quote, "We're playing really good baseball," Griffith said. "We're hitting 1-9. We're hitting a midseason stride at the end of the season," end quote. And in today's Living section, Kat Russell reports on a 9-year-old and his dad who kayaked the entire Cedar River to raise money for Make-A-Wish Foundation. We don't have time for the whole story, but we can share that it was an adventure Benjamin Winninger and his 9-year-old son Liam had been talking about for a while. Quote, "We would talk about kayaking and wonder if people had kayaked Cedar River from start to finish, and a plan grew from there," Winninger said. "And that's when my dad said, if we're going to do something this big, we should do it for charity," Liam said. So Liam started researching charity organizations and set his sights on the Make-A-Wish Foundation, a national nonprofit organization that helps fulfill the wishes of terminally ill children between the ages of 2.5 and 17 years old. Quote, "I liked that if you raised enough money, you could help a sick kid get to do something really cool, like go to Disney World or go to a water park or be a pirate," Liam said. On July 4th, the pair put their kayaks in at Hayfield, Minnesota, and began their 16-day trip down the river. 15 of those days were spent on the water, and 1 was spent waiting out some bad weather. Down the Cedar River, then on to where it merges with the Iowa River at Columbus Junction, and then across the Mississippi River to their final destination in New Boston, Illinois. Along the way, their family, Winninger's wife and Liam's 2 sisters, would drive out and meet them at their stops on the river, bringing them food and other treats, and giving them a much-needed break from the never-ending paddling. As they traveled, they met interesting people, encountered lots of wildlife, and racked up a bunch of stories to tell when they got home. Winninger and Liam made it to Illinois on Friday, but seeing that they were so close, they decided to go on a little bit farther and do a little kayaking on the Mississippi River. They got back home to Waterloo on Saturday, exhausted but happy and proud of their accomplishment, and humbled by all the support they received during their journey. Their goal, aside from completing the journey, was to raise $2,500 for Make-A-Wish Foundation. The pair had already raised more than $6,300 as of Monday, and will continue accepting donations until the end of the month. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.